This is an ABC Radio National podcast. For full details, abc.net.au/rn.
This is ABC Radio National, and yes, that's Mozart, the clarinet quintet, the first record I ever bought. But this version is like no other you've heard. That music is now 40 billion kilometres away, travelling on a disc carried by the Voyager spacecraft, launched in 1977. It seems an appropriate way for the Science Show to wish Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart a happy 250th birthday. Hello, I'm Robin Williams. Well, the news from a little further out in space, as published in the journal Nature on Thursday, is very exciting. Yes, it's another new planet, but this one, for the first time, is not a giant lump of gas like Jupiter. It's a rock like ours. The team responsible for finding it is international, but here's one of them, Dr. John Greenhill from the University of Tasmania, with its enthralling name.
Well, I'm afraid the name's Ogle 2005-BLG-390B.
It's very exciting. It's tempting to call it Ogle Bogle.
I don't know whether... Well, there's quite a long list of these exoplanets, as we call them now, and they all have very boring names. And
well, forgive me, I will call it Ogle Bogle, but in the meantime, it is the first of the small planets, the rocky planets, as opposed to the big gaseous ones. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. There are about 170 known planets, and they're mostly very massive, typically more as massive as Jupiter, unless they're very close to the parent star. But all of them are unlike solar system planets because, well, it's conceivable there could be one or two rocky planets very close in, but then they would be at temperatures of thousands of degrees. So the tendency is to call them hot Jupiters.
How do you know that this is a small rocky one?
That's a fairly a long story, Robin, but basically what happens is that when one star passes in front of another, you get a brightening as the foreground star passes in front of the background star, and that changes with time, so you get a characteristic bell-shaped curve. If you have a planet around the foreground star, you see somewhere or other in the light curve, as we call it, a sudden bump, which might last a few hours or a few days. Then it goes away, and that's the last we ever see of the planet. It's the only signal it ever gives us. But by doing detailed mathematical modelling, you're able to determine the mass and the orbital radius of the planet.
I see, so you can tell one bump from the other, which is very good, using those sort of indirect measurements.
That's
but
correct. Yeah.
It's 22,000 light years away. It's in Sagittarius. And the star, its own sun, is something like a fifth the size of our own. Is that right?
Yeah, it's one of the most common stars in the galaxy, which are M stars, which are M dwarfs, we call them, and they're generally a few tenths of a solar mass.
And presumably, being far away from its own sun, it'd be pretty damn cold there.
Yeah, that's the disappointing thing about it. You have to be pretty close to an M star to keep warm enough to support life.
So how cold is it down there?
Well, we're estimating at about minus 220 Celsius.
Yeah, yes, yeah. So that's worse than Moscow at the moment.
Considerably worse, yeah. Yeah, it's something not very different, I think, from Neptune.
And if it is five times the size of the Earth, what's gravity like? If I weigh something like 60, 70 kilos, what would I weigh on that place?
Well, we have to make an assumption about what the density of the planet is, but since we expect it will almost certainly be rocky and icy, so the density may be a bit less than Earth, but at the best estimates we can make is that it'll be around 70% stronger surface gravity. That's a maximum. So if you were 60 kilograms, you'd weigh about 100 on this planet. So at least you could stand up on it before you froze to death.
Well, you're clearly saying that life is unlikely in a place like that.
I think it's extremely unlikely, yes. But the important thing is that it's telling us that statistics are small numbers, but it's certainly pointing very much toward the idea that these sort of rocky, small-mass, low-mass planets are common, and so we're expecting in the next few years to turn up planets like Earth, although they're around M-dwarfs, they're always going to be pretty chilly.
Yes, but you have got the techniques to look for places like Earth where life might exist.
Yeah, that's the exciting thing about microlensing. We started in this game 10 years ago, and it's been a pretty slow process. But meanwhile, other people have been finding all sorts of exotic planets, and we're finding nothing. But now we're starting. This is the first step in finding Earth-mass planets, and that's for the next 4 or 5 years anyway. Microlensing will be the only way in which Earth-mass planets can be detected.
And it's an international study, is it not? How many people were involved? Perth, for example, was crucial.
Perth was very crucial, yes. They happened to be online at the time of the peak of the planetary deviation, and they got a whole set of measurements. They have their telescopes automated, so they were immediately onto it, and that's one of the things we've been learning, is that you have to be very quick. If you're going to catch an Earth, you've got to be very quick to recognise the event and then measure it as hard as you can.
Now, how is this sort of thing happening? Are you scanning the sky and you just happen to be looking around Sagittarius, or is it more systematic than that?
Yeah, we're very fortunate that there are now two survey teams named Ogle and MOA, the Polish-American collaboration based in Chile, and then there's another New Zealand-Japanese collaboration based in Christchurch, and they are both scanning selected regions of the sky, quite a large area toward the galactic centre, and they measure millions of stars every night looking for microlensing events to occur. And once they see the characteristic change in the brightness of a star, they issue an alert to the astronomical community, and it's that stage that the Planet Collaboration, of which we're members, they come online, and we then start making frequent observations of the events which we consider most likely to find planets in. The Ogle and MOA people between them will probably this coming year find something around 1,000 microlensing events. And of that, we might select 50 or 60, which are easily measured and which have the characteristics which are most likely to show up a planet.
Have you ever had the alarm and gone rushing to the telescope? And, well, I don't want to be unkind about Hobart, but and the sky is covered?
That's not uncommon. The interesting thing about Hobart weather, frustrating for the observers, but you'll get data almost every night. There'll be a break in the clouds, but it's not very often we get what are called photometric conditions when the sky is clear all night. So you just get used to it. We go out every night anyway, and we just keep measuring when we can.
Congratulations. I think it's very exciting.
Thank you, Robin.
John Greenhill from the University of Tasmania, and I find that very exciting. With me is Jonathan Nally, who looks almost excited. Do you find it thrilling as I did?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, little over 10 years ago, this was science fiction, this stuff. This was just unbelievable 11 or 12 years ago. It was suspected these things were out there, but now we have the proof. We're actually finding them, which is incredible.
An M star. Now, I heard a rumour from John Greenhill that you actually told them in Hobart once not to bother to look for these little things, but to look for G stars. Is that right?
Would I have done that? No, actually, I remember speaking to an astronomer, I won't mention his name, probably about 12 or 13 years ago, just before the first planets were detected in 95. And I was asking him about the possibility of spotting other planets, particularly small ones, and, you know, maybe even taking pictures of them. And he said, no, we'll never be able to do that. The signal to noise is too great, blah, 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 all the reasons why not. But, you know, it's happening now. And within the next 10, 15 years, we're going to actually be able to take images of planets around other stars. And even sooner than that, in fact, they're doing it right now. They're working out what the atmospheres of some of these other planets are like. And now with these smaller planets being detected, Earth-sized ones, we're not too far away from being able to detect what gases are in the atmosphere and whether some of those gases are the telltale signatures of life as we know it. So it's fantastic stuff.
Brilliant. Now, one thing we didn't mention last week was a mission that was sort of postponed and postponed.
Hmm.
This one to Pluto, and it went and it took off.
It went, took off, and at a great rate of knots. In fact, the fastest spacecraft ever to leave Earth has to go fast because it's got a long way to go.
How old will I be when it gets there?
Depends on how old you are now, but it's going to get there in July 2015, so you do the maths. But yeah, it's a long way to go. And you know, they've been wanting to get a Pluto mission going for many, many years, because the thing with Pluto It has a really eccentric orbit around the Sun. All the other planets go around in roughly circles around the Sun, but Pluto's got a sort of squashed orbit. And it goes a long way out at its farthest point in its orbit, and it's heading towards that now. And the further out it goes, the colder it gets. And the very, very thin atmosphere it has on it, I think it's about a thousandth as thin as Earth's, is eventually going to freeze onto the surface because it gets so cold. And they're not too far away from that. So this thing should just get there in time to be able to analyse the atmosphere as well as the surface of the planet and its moon.
And you do accept that Pluto is a planet because it has a moon, as you said.
Oh, look, there's this big question of what is a planet and what does not. I mean, historically and sentimentally, it's a planet as far as I'm concerned. But look, there could be 1,000 Pluto-like things out there. They've already found other ones. Sedna and all sorts of other weird ones they're finding out there. There could be thousands of them around that size. So what constitutes a planet? Well, as far as I'm concerned, Pluto's a planet, just sentimentally. But it's weird. It's a weird object. It doesn't fit in with all the rest. So where did it come from? Did it form out there? Was it captured from somewhere else? And if there are lots of them out there, what does this tell us about our understanding of our present theories of formations of solar systems and these other solar systems that are out there, like this planet's been discovered around another star? So it's important we study these things. And as someone has commented, one of the scientists involved in the Pluto mission, we could write down what we know about Pluto right now on the back of a postage stamp. We know it's there, how far away it is, what its orbit's like, roughly what it's made of, very roughly. That's it. That's all we know. In 10 years' time, we're going to know thousands, millions of times more than we've ever known about the planet.
You will come in then and chat.
Oh, if you invite me nicely, yeah, I suppose.
Okay, fine. What other things do we have on the horizon to look forward to?
Oh, look, it's just going to be a brilliant year, in fact, a brilliant next few years. We've got a spacecraft on the way to Venus, which is fantastic. We've got spacecraft on the way to Mercury. Do you know, just this weekend, this program goes to air. It's 20 years since the Challenger space shuttle blew up. It is actually 20 years. And look what's happened in all those years. It's just absolutely remarkable. The space shuttle itself is on hold until at least May this year. Hopefully it'll fly again. And it's only, what, 4 years now before it's supposed to be retired. And also the space station's supposed to be sort of half finished. When it's finished, they're going to make it. And then they're off to the moon. Big problems with NASA, of course, at the moment is that so much money is being redirected towards the moon and eventual Mars program that a lot of science programs are being cut and some missions are being delayed. These are the robotic missions out to other planets. A lot of people are very unhappy with this, including myself. I think it's great to be able to go to the moon and Mars, but you know, I watched President Bush's speech about this a couple of years ago and just didn't really grab me. It's great to do it, but it's very expensive and there isn't at the moment a really compelling reason to do it. In the 60s was to beat the Russians. And rightly or wrongly, everyone got behind it. But I don't see a lot of people getting behind this. And it all depends on what the next administration thinks about it, of course. And the danger that they run there, next administration comes in and says, this is a lot of rubbish, let's get rid of it. And you've had all this upheaval in NASA, which doesn't need any more upheaval. And missions cancelled, staff laid off, scientists gone elsewhere. And you can see the Europeans taking over in the realm of solar system exploration. And shortly, well, not far behind them are the Chinese, then the Indians, then the Japanese. And Australia, nowhere to be seen, of course.
Well, odd that, because you've been thinking about John Howard, have you not?
Oh, John Howard, yes. Well, look, he's a remarkable man. We're very, very fortunate to have him in this country, you know, a brilliant scientist, philosopher. Did you know he invented time travel?
Tell me.
No one really knows about this. They sort of kept it a bit of a secret. But yes, he's the first person in the world to invent time travel and actually make it work. You see, all these years ago, he invented a thing called a generator of space and time, or GST. And with it, you can instantly transport yourself back to the 1950s, you see. But unfortunately, at the moment, it only goes one way. It doesn't quite go forward progressively. But look, they're probably working on that. It's a very complex piece of machinery, and not everyone's allowed to use it. To get to use this, you see, you have to go through all sorts of things they call, I think, like by-elections and pre-selections. And it's almost like a religion. You get into a thing called the ministry. A ministry, right? You become a minister. It's like a bishop. And if you're really good and you behave yourself, then they might stick you inside a thing called the cabinet, where they have these things called economic levers or something or other, and you sort of do this and do that, and yeah, it sort of goes backwards. They need to sort of figure out, make it go forwards, don't they?
For the first time, I've been able to understand some of the machinations behind the cabinet replacements that happened this week. Jonathan Nally, thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Jonathan Nally, editor of Australian Sky and Telescope magazine, is clearly a member of the Nationals. And before him, Dr. John Greenhill at the University of Tasmania in Hobart, talking about cabinet. Australia has a new Minister of Education, Training and Science. She's Julie Bishop, and she already has a terrific reputation. Here she is on Scientists.
In my first year as a member of the House of Representatives, I was approached by the Science Meets Parliament organisers and said, would you like to meet some of the scientists? What we're trying to do is enhance Member of Parliament's knowledge about the value of science to our community. And I thought, what a wonderful initiative, scientists coming to meet politicians. You couldn't find two more diverse groups. And every year I've found it worthwhile meeting scientists one-on-one, talking about the work that they do and exchanging ideas. I think it's been a most valuable initiative.
And here's Julie Bishop on preparing for the burgeoning information society, as it's called.
Well, I think many sides of the community are overwhelmed with information. And when you talk about the internet, well, so many of us now seem to assess our own health condition and what's wrong with us by looking up the internet. And that's one of the problems, I guess, with coming across a new area that you need to get on top of. What would be ideal is if I had a better background in science. Now, I tended to do liberal arts subjects at school. I wish I'd paid more attention to the physics, chemistry, basic science. And so my word for all students going through primary or secondary school is focus on the science subjects, because you never know when you're going to need it and rely upon it.
And finally, Julie Bishop, on whether there's any kind of job you can do in the 21st century without some background in science.
Essentially, no. Not only from the high-end IT perspective, but any job, wherever you're working, you must have some understanding of the environment around you. And science is all around you. So when you put it down so simply, I suspect that there's not a job, there's not a career path that you could have that would not involve some fundamental understanding of science. But then, of course, there'll be so many jobs in the 21st century that will involve a much higher level appreciation, understanding and application of scientific principles.
And I suppose you'd have more than one job. You'd have about 20 different careers in this varied life.
That seems to be the trend, and we're seeing younger people seeing it as a matter of some pride that they've had a number of jobs, whereas in the past it used to be a job for a lifetime. But now people must be more flexible, more innovative, more creative in what they do.
Julie Bishop on The Science Show last year when she was Minister for the Aged. As of this week, she's the new Minister for Education, Science and Training. Welcome. This is The Science Show on ABC Radio National. And tell me this, have you noticed that science documentaries on TV, especially those from the BBC, are beginning to look like The Bill? Over the top, hysterical, and even somewhat loopy. This was on SBS a couple of weeks ago.
Our day of reckoning has come and gone. Most life has literally been devoured by something called nanotechnology. Tiny machines that were designed to save the human race. But instead, they turned on us. Human life has been wiped out by the nanobot.
Master of understatement. Oddly enough, that was supposed to be a program about Hendrik Schön of Bell Labs and how he faked his research papers. That would have been interesting. Instead, we got the end of the world times 10. Well, I asked for a second opinion. Who better than the BBC Horizon veteran Dick Gilling, the man who gave us Quantum? Dick.
It was a severe shock to realise that the last time Robin and I worked together was, well, shall we say, more than 10 years ago. Quite a bit more, really. Robin was recording half-hour interviews with distinguished Australian scientists, among them Peter Singer, Adrian Clarke, and Mike Archer, for, of all things, ABC Television, which had grudgingly agreed to show them, rather late in the evening. The budget was roughly nothing. The series was called The Uncertainty Principle, and it was just one of the science television programmes ABC used to produce at that time. We had, of course, the weekly magazine series Quantum, but we also did a series on astronomy, Skywatch, specials, for example, on Halley's Comet, and a few one-hour documentaries we either produced ourselves or commissioned from independent Australian producers. Now, these documentaries formed part of a series called Discovery, where we also ran shows we bought from the BBC Horizon series, or Channel 4's Equinox, or the American Nova series. We had the pick of the crop, and the series ran in summertime, and it rated its socks off. To the astonishment of David Hill, the then managing director of the ABC, people actually enjoyed science on TV. It's about these so-called flagship docos that I want to talk. And if this sounds like a sermon, that's because it is. The other night, both Robin and I saw a BBC Horizon show on SBS. It was called The Dark Secret of Hendrik Schön. Allegedly about a celebrated science fraud, it was in fact a load of twaddle about a scary future awaiting us in the shape of grey swarms of nanobots, a speculative and indeed fictional organic electronic device. The fascinating real story, how a young scientist made claim after claim for astonishing discoveries, which though completely fraudulent were universally accepted, occupied about 10 minutes. The rest, 45, was more or less rubbish, prettily photographed. When the Horizon logo came up on screen, I became incandescent with rage. I had worked on Horizon from 1964 to 1983, at a time when we struggled and eventually succeeded in getting great science on screen and great scientists to tell us their stories and let us question them. People like J.Z. Young, Paul Dirac, Steven Weinberg, the Australian John Eccles, all of them Nobel laureates, and of course many others. Now, why did SBS choose to show this dark secret nonsense? Why, for that matter, did ABC show Secrets of the Star Disk, another less-than-scientific science show from Horizon? Well, answer, presumably, ratings. And that's also why the shows are made in the first place. At a party for the 40th anniversary of Horizon at the end of 2004, there was much criticism of the perceived dumbing down of the series, of the way in which sensational stories were preferred to the descriptive and, yes, okay, educational programmes of 20 years before. And shows about sensational subjects, volcanoes, earthquakes, dinosaurs and sundry disasters, real sometimes but often imagined, do get high ratings and sometimes even awards, but they do not often promote the public understanding of science, something most science broadcasters would think fairly important. Let me be clear. A TV programme that nobody watches doesn't do any of us any good. But those of us who worked in public broadcasting remember the aims stated by Lord Reith, the first head of the BBC. And they were that broadcasts were to inform, to educate, and to entertain. Nowadays, we might move entertain a bit higher up the list, but surely not make it the only purpose. However, that, it seems, is what is happening across the world. If you consult the websites for Horizon and for the American Nova and the UK Channel 4's Equinox, all feature many similar titles. Dinosaurs, disasters, volcanoes, and forensic pathology. There is no ABC website for our old Discovery programme, because it no longer exists. Perhaps not many people will lament the apparent passing of the less sensational, more informative TV shows. The syndrome is not confined to science anyway. Channel 4 recently renamed one of their history series. It was called History Lab. It is now called Secrets of the Dead. And the brief is to include at least one exhumation per show. The ultimate cause, as usual, is money. Commercial TV shows need to attract advertising dollars. But public TV and radio have to show that they deserve public money. And high ratings are an easy way to claim that and prolong their financial support. Horizon is also evidently now co-producing with the Discovery Channel, which is likely to demand easily digested popular shows. Of course, there are good TV science documentaries still being made. Sadly, neither the ABC nor SBS appear to have much will to show them, at least not in a coherent series. Occasionally they may pop up in Four Corners or somewhere, but blink and you can miss them, which is a shame. When the BBC and the others find no one wants their real science shows, they will stop making them altogether and they won't come back. Well, Not until real science is cool again. Which, sorry Robin, looks like it might be a long time.
It might well. Dick Gilling worked on Ascent of Man with Jacob Bronowski, Horizon as you heard, and also he set up Quantum, the predecessor to Catalyst, about 20 years ago. And Catalyst, by the way, returns at the end of March. Horizon once more.
This is the story of the man behind the most remarkable discovery. His breakthrough seemed so revolutionary, it could have created an extraordinary new world. A world where disease could be destroyed before the first symptoms appear. Where nothing would be beyond the boundaries of human knowledge. But others thought it could also be a world where the darkest evil could be unleashed. Where microscopic machines would link up to destroy us all.
It could solve all of our technology problems and give us a techno-utopia, or it could wipe us out and cause complete extinction. We really have to think very carefully before we go down that sort of a road.
This amazing world could have been brought a step closer by the brilliant mind of Jan Hendrik Schoen.
What Hendrik had reported was just so amazing that we used to joke at lunch that either he's going to Stockholm to pick up that Nobel Prize or he's going to jail.
Tonight, Horizon tells the astonishing saga of Jan Hendrik Schoen and his discovery that could have changed everything.
And rumour is that they've got a new editor and that the programmes will improve. You can see them on SBS television on Sundays at 8:30 p.m. where there is a regular science documentary spot. At the moment it's on sex advice from Dr. Tatiana. If you need advice, it's highly recommended. Which brings me to the internet, full of sex of course, but also full of information. The internet is now 15 years old, and accordingly, Professor Bill Dutton has done a study of who's using it.
Well, for example, if you look at people of school age, 98% are using the internet. If you look at people who are retired or of retirement age, 30% are online. So people have focused a bit too much attention on economic constraints and geographical constraints on access to the internet. And we need to focus more attention on why people out of habit or cultural predisposition choose not to be online when they could very well afford it, very well benefit by it.
What reasons do you get as to why they don't want to know?
Our research illustrates that the internet is what we've called an experience technology. You can explain to somebody what the internet is about, but when they experience it, they get it. The other week, I could not find several articles in my office. I found them on the World Wide Web within seconds, and I realized I could find an article faster somewhere else in the world than I could in my own office, even though I've been using the internet for decades. The experience continues to inform me more than the sort of rational discussion of medium.
Bill Dutton is director of the Oxford Internet Institute. He's an enthusiast. Some of us, however, often get marooned inside alleys where the information is promised but isn't quite there. Eventually, you give up.
Well, I mean, you're very much on tune with a lot of people who argue that the internet is one big garbage heap and you can ferret around and maybe find a treasure somewhere in that. But I think most people, their experience has been surprise at the good material they do find. And I think search engine technology is perhaps one of the most dramatic innovations of the last 5 years, and they're getting better and better. And I think there are many search engines. Google is the most important, but there are literally dozens of well-used search engines. They all give somewhat different results. They're all trying to learn from one another. That technology is going to get better. They're going to have qualitative ratings as well as numbers of hits and numbers of links. So I think people are going to be increasingly surprised by the sophistication of search engine technology and the ability to find what you need.
So in what way, say in 5 years' time, might I notice that this fragmented experience that I may have, if I don't quite know what I'm looking for, how will that improve?
Well, I think there'll probably be better capabilities of deciphering. Well, you can already do searches for exact phrases and sets of keywords, and My big worry is that too small a proportion of even younger people who use the internet are using it more as consumers of information rather than producers of information. So one of my big concerns right now is that how do we promote an understanding of the media, that the internet is not broadcasting, that it's not something you need only passively consume, but it's something that kids, anyone, can actually produce for, whether it's putting together a blog or doing an interview or putting their essay online and so forth. And in Britain, only about 10% of the users are actually actively producing anything for the web, sending attachments, sending photos, putting up text, making a website, creating a blog. And I think that's an important push to get people to produce as well as consume.
Is this one of the conclusions you've got from your survey? You're talking about ways in which it's affecting society, that some people are taking it rather too passively, that not being involved themselves means that they will not be effective users of it.
Yeah, I think so. I think a high school student can produce something that's read by thousands, if not millions of people. A blogger in Iraq can become famous and change the way in which a war is reported. So it's changing the producers, the gatekeepers, and who consumes what. And it changes the geographical range of any written or other piece of work, and it changes the time horizon of a piece. Historical material will become accessible, etc. That's a capability. It's not a reality. For example, you can get entirely new material on the internet than you would in paper, but only about 20% of people who use the internet for news actually read material online that they don't already read in print. Okay, but about 20% do. About 20% of people who are online actually meet people online. They make friends online, or they make friends and meet people that they meet online.
Some of them get arrested online as well.
The online is very much like offline. It's just as exciting as the real world.
One person who was talking a little while ago about the future of the internet, Lord Oxborough, who was at Imperial College, pointed out that half the people in the world haven't made a phone call yet, let alone used a computer. That's being disputed these days as a changing circumstance. I know you did your survey of mainly Britain, but if you look at the wider world, are you seeing a bridging of that gap between those who actually have access to this sort of amazing new technology and the people who in older times did not get any at all?
Well, I think there has been for decades a thesis that technology will sometime enable people to leapfrog older technology and not have to go through the stages of development of every other country from telephone and so forth. But I think there's a need to be cautious about that, because I think the idea that there will be a technological fix to a digital divide is not very clear. For example, even in Britain, a highly developed country, there's already a plateauing of internet diffusion. So only about a third of Britons are not online, and they plateaued at about 60% of people 14 years old and over. The U.S. has plateaued around 70%. So even in the developed countries, there are those who are not online. Now, again, they may have chosen to, but they're also, it's related to economic wherewithal as well. But in developing countries, the idea is that, well, once we have mobile technology, digital
mobile phones and so on.
Yeah, with Wi-Fi capability and so forth, that everyone will be online, and phone calls and internet access and so forth, that we'll have a terminal so cheap that people can give it away. But again, I think it's not just equipment. The use of the internet and finding the right material, producing for the internet, being able to consume it intelligently is a package of equipment, technique, literacy, the ability to understand the context in which you're searching for material and so forth. So there's no reason to be complacent about trying to. I think the digital divide is something that we'll continue to tackle. The technology is also developing at such a fast pace. When I first studying digital divide issues in the early 1980s, everyone said, wait a few years and everyone will have a personal computer, etc. Well, now, I mean, it's hard to keep up even in the most developed countries.
And, of course, the internet has been a terrific boon to terrorists. Bill Dutton at Balliol College, Oxford, where he's Professor of Internet Studies. But there's another way to exchange vital information. Gossip around the water cooler, or teapot if you prefer. Here's Deb Richards from Macquarie University.
In the recent past, a group of employees chatting around the water cooler might cause the boss to think, get back to work, you're wasting your time and my money. But what the boss didn't realise was that the chat wasn't just idle gossip. When one employee complained that X was late again, the colleague was also learning that it would be better to choose another supplier for that product, or to get his orders in earlier and expect delays. This type of information is not so likely to crop up at a formal meeting. For one thing, meetings have agendas and people need to stick to them to finish on time. Unless a review of that supplier was on the agenda and the complaining employee remembered the incident and was given the opportunity to discuss it, it would not have become shared knowledge. In the water cooler situation, there was also the opportunity for the other worker to ask something like, who else would you recommend, or even to suggest an alternative themselves. Large companies are rediscovering some business basics. The appropriateness of hierarchy, formal meetings and technology in the modern organisation are being challenged. Researchers into knowledge management have found that the pre-industrial revolution cottage-based industry was a better environment for fostering knowledge gathering and sharing. There are two main types of knowledge. Firstly, there is codified knowledge. It includes rules of conduct, etiquette, and even mathematical formulas. It is knowledge that we've been able to put into words and is typically written down. The other type of knowledge is what is being transferred at the water cooler. It's known as tacit knowledge. It includes knowledge that we can articulate, such as, don't buy from Y because they're unreliable, to there's something about them that makes me suspicious. Tacit knowledge is not gained from reading books. It is gained via hands-on experience, like riding a bike or driving a car. Studies show that we use roughly equal amounts of codified and tacit knowledge in our day-to-day activities. But tacit knowledge is what gives us a competitive edge over others. Tacit knowledge resides in individuals, and it's sticky. To get it from someone else, you need to be in contact with them. Frequent, informal, and face-to-face contact is seen to be the best way to share tacit knowledge. In contrast, contractors, workers from home, and part-time employees have little opportunity to interact socially, a situation that is less than ideal. Sending people on training courses, reading the manual, getting people to document everything can all help with increasing our codified knowledge. But to increase our tacit knowledge, we need to do, rather than listen or read, and we need other people. So what strategies are being used to increase tacit knowledge? One approach involves team-building activities, such as role-playing, social events, and even weekends away. Coaching or mentoring is also gaining popularity at the corporate level. In a return to our primeval times, storytelling and narratives have made a comeback as a way of describing what is both good and bad business practice. The descriptions are richer and more engaging than those recorded in a database or information system. Capturing knowledge is recognised as the bottleneck in managing knowledge. There are two main reasons for this. Firstly, experts like to be indispensable and fear that their position will be threatened if they disclose what they know. Secondly, experts often can't explain why they made a certain decision. Even when they offer an explanation or describe what they know or do, they often actually don't do it that way when you watch them. But people love to tell their stories in graphic and gory detail. Match the storyteller with an audience trying to solve a similar problem, and you have two motivated parties willing and able to communicate at a level that email, meetings, and manuals will never be able to achieve. Many large multinationals are using an approach which brings together groups of people within the organisation who share common roles, skills, or interests. These groups are known as communities of practice, and they interact so that its members can find out tricks of the trade, share war stories, and ask for expert advice. The supporting technology need be no more than a web-based chat room or discussion forum. It's the people and their experiences that make a community of practice a success or a failure. Technology is also being used to ensure that the right people are being put into the right situations for knowledge exchange. Companies are tracking their social networks to map who knows who, how often they meet, what type of meeting it is, how important it is to meet, and even who they try to avoid. The technique was used back in 1996 by police to track down the Belanglo State Forest murderer Ivan Milat. Well, social network analysis is not just for identifying criminals and their victims. The modern organisation is using these maps to see whether people are mixing within the organisation. If the analysis reveals cliques or bottlenecks, the company knows to take action to break down communication barriers. The male boy who's found a better way should be able to access the company's CEO. And open access also means a change to office design. Instead of people being locked away in their own rooms, open plan offices, comfy lunch and recreation areas, complete with healthy bowls of fruit, are the latest trend. Well, we knew all along that no matter what the company sold, we were its most valuable resource. It might have taken a couple of hundred years, but senior management have finally worked this out too. So just smile back at your boss next time he sees you chatting by the water cooler. You're working overtime.
Deb Richards is Associate Professor in Computer Studies at Macquarie University. And so to our final frolic on communication in this science show, this time on a truck. It's a lab in a lorry, and I found it in Dublin. It's also gone to Africa, and maybe one day it'll come here. It is, after all, the brainchild of an astronomer from Australia. Our first trucking scientist is practically hoarse from explaining his stuff to hundreds of kids.
Okay, what we've done is we've measured the frequency at which it wants to resonate. And now what we're going to do is we're going to feed that frequency back into the glass and see what happens.
Away you go.
Okay, so I've already tuned it, so let's just turn up the volume. So as we turn up the volume, the rim of the glass is starting to go fuzzy.
Ah, yes, it's vibrating and I can see there's a light on it. It's inside a glass box, actually, so it's fairly safe if it shatters.
So now I'm going to turn on a strobe light, which will make it appear to move much more slowly. Instead of it moving at 300 times every second, you get slowed down to about once or twice every second. So you actually see the edge of the glass moving by 5 or 6 millimetres each way.
And that's extraordinary that it stays stable. Why doesn't it just shatter?
Basically, modern glasses are really good quality. I'll just turn it down. And it's really flexible, so even though it's bending by 5 or 6 millimetres, it doesn't break. Old-fashioned ones tended to have more flaws in them or possibly slight scratches when they were washed. So it's possible that an opera singer, if they were singing in a dodgy glass, would have been able to break them.
Is there a level at which you can turn up the apparatus here and shatter that one?
Not with this glass. I've tried many times, but not quite yet. I have done it with another piece of apparatus, but that was even louder than this.
Now, we're in the lab on the truck. What is the advantage of having this sort of apparatus for kids when they come in to have a look?
Well, if a kid sees glass bending by 5 or 6 millimetres, it just makes them go, wow, basically. And if they've gone wow, it's amazing you get them interested and possibly get them to learn something in the next couple of minutes while they're still interested.
And meanwhile, you're finishing your PhD in Cambridge in what?
I've been trying to build a machine to measure the magnetic field produced by a slice of rat brain.
A slice of rat brain produces a magnetic field?
Yeah, that's because the information travels around your brain through the nerves as electric signals, and an electric current will produce a magnetic field. So the idea is to measure the magnetic field and learn something about those electric currents.
Even if the rat's dead?
If you cut the rat up quick enough, then the cells are still alive, and you can cut it up within a couple of minutes in an oxygen and glucose solution, then it'll live for about 12 or 13 hours.
This truck, back on the truck, how far are you taking it around the streets and highways?
It's going all the way around Great Britain, and in fact one of the lorries is even going to South Africa. I'm heading off for the next week and a half to South Africa for 6 weeks and taking it around deprived schools in South Africa.
With your glass?
With my glass and my soundproof box, indeed.
How wonderful. Now, introduce me to another of your... Who's over there in the red?
That's Joanna Dunlop, who's funding the whole lorry.
Well, I shall go and talk to her now. Thank you. Well, here we are outside the lorry with the aforementioned Joanna Dunlop, who is the sponsor. On what basis?
I represent the Schlumberger Foundation, which along with the Institute of Physics is funding the lab in a lorry, and which was the original sponsor of the programme.
And you've got a number of experiments. We've already heard about one. We're going to hear about a couple more. But what is the advantage of taking these experiments around the highways and byways for people simply to come on board and have a look?
The experiments have been designed such that they allow multiple avenues of questioning, so they really engage the children. Essential to that are the volunteers, who are all practicing scientists. So the combination of their enthusiasm, the opportunity for children to experience their own curiosity and get their hands dirty and hear lots of noises and explosions and what have you, is very engaging. And really all that we're trying to achieve is to be a spark, perhaps even a turning point for one or two children who might 30 years from now be famous scientists, and somebody will say, well, what you got you into science?
The lorry.
The lorry, lab in a lorry.
And was it your idea?
No, the idea came from Charles Jenkins, Dr. Charles Jenkins, who at that time was a research scientist with Schlumberger, based in the UK. Unfortunately, he's left Schlumberger and he's living in Australia. He's an astronomer, Charles is, and it was his idea, and that was 5 years ago.
And it's working, it's been working well ever since.
Well, it started as a pilot, it had a hiatus, and then it went full-scale on the road, so we hope to see lab in a lorry in some form, certainly mobile science, to be rolled out in many more countries.
Back inside the lorry, and I'm with Michelle. Is your name Michelle?
Yes, I'm Michelle.
Now, before I ask you about your particular experiment, which involves all sorts of green fluids and sticky stuff, what is the science of Kung Fu?
The science of Kung Fu. There's actually quite a lot of physics in Kung Fu. It's actually all to do with channeling energy and directing energy in certain ways, using your body in the most efficient way possible to direct a force onto, you know, someone else in a punch or breaking a board or something like that.
And you do it?
I spent a couple of days working with this martial arts expert, learning how to break a board in two with my bare hands. We actually did some experiments to find out all the energies involved in breaking a board. How much energy would I need? How fast do I have to, my hands have to travel to break the board? So we worked it all out beforehand. So that actually was, for me, the important thing, to have the confidence that I knew that I could actually do it.
I think you break your fist instead of breaking the board.
Yeah, that's what you think. Wood, you think it's strong, but actually, once you've understood all the different forces involved, you can see just by working out the numbers that actually if you hit it in a certain way, if you've got the technique right, you can actually break it. Without, it's quite easy if you know how.
But you don't do it on the lorry?
No, the lorry is more for kids to have a go, really.
And what's the one in front of me with all sorts of beakers and green stuff?
This one's called the Reluctant Oil Well, and the green gunge is actually, it's our version of oil. It's actually coloured glycerin, but the idea of this experiment is to simulate getting oil out of the ground. And so the green goo is in this plastic cell, which is supposed to be like rock in the earth. And we asked children, how do they think they could get that green gunge out in the most quick and easy way possible?
And if you just pull on the plunger, what happens? Nothing?
If you just try and suck it out using a syringe, it is pretty much nothing. You have to be very, very strong to do that, because the glycerin is so viscous, it's extremely difficult. Most of the groups, they kind of have a go. They have some ideas about the different ways of doing it. They'll try all of them, and they'll see that the best way of doing it is to actually pump air into the cell quite steadily and slowly, and the air will actually gradually, gently push the oil out, the glycerin out, the green gunge, and that's the best way of doing it, which is actually the way that people get oil out of the ground. People pump water into the ground and that pushes the oil out of the rocks. All the children just want to get messy.
They love goo.
Yeah, it's the green goo. It just looks brilliant, you know, it's loads of fun. You just get green stuff all over the place. That's the main attraction for this particular experiment.
When you're not playing with goo and when you're not actually breaking wood, what do you do?
I'm actually about to start a PhD in atmospheric physics, the way the atmosphere behaves in the Sahara. The Sahara is very hot and dry, whereas nearby is more tropical, more wet. And there's also dust from the Sahara. It's swept right up into the atmosphere. And you might have heard sometimes in Europe and in America, dust actually falls down overnight. You just wake up and there's a coating of dust everywhere, because the dust from the Sahara gets swept right up to the upper atmosphere, transported all the way halfway across the world, and then suddenly the weather changes and all the dust falls down onto the ground.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
The Lab in a Lorry, brainchild of Dr. Charles Jenkins at Mount Stromlo in Canberra. And yes, they are liaising with Questacon about an Australian tour. Well, next week on The Science Show, Tasmanian Devils, Insects and the Death of a Magazine. Production today by Paulie Newman, Polly Rickard and Janita Palmer. I'm Robin Williams, and here's Mozart, 40 billion kilometres out in space.
ABC Radio National. More than 60 programs, more than 260 transmitters Australia-wide. And we're live on the net as well as media on demand streams. Find out how to get more out of Radio National. Go to abc.net.au/rn. And for the full list of MP3 and podcast programs, abc.net.au/rn/podcast.